sermon text, Ecclesiastes 9:13 through 10:7. Page 558 of your pew Bible. Ecclesiastes 9:13 through 10:7. I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. But one sinner destroys much good. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he is a fool. The anger of the ruler rises against you. Do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. Our scene today is in the court of a king. Where else do you find complete, unqualified trust expected from the objects of a discipline for its practitioners like you find in government? The demand for trust. Trust us. We know what is best for you. Where is the humility amongst our rulers? There was amongst our founding fathers. That's why they tried to limit government. They knew very well the tendency toward hubris and the accumulation of power by those who govern. Is there no admitting that someone could make a mistake, be in error, employ the wrong policy, perhaps hurt the people? Where is the frank admission that human fallibility is at work here, as well as in every human endeavor? Doctors and medical practitioners take great care in medical protocol to ensure that a right diagnosis is obtained and a correct regime of treatment is prescribed. Diagnosis, prescription, and prognosis. Tests. Measures, multiple opinions, peer reviews, scrupulously employed to make sure that mistakes are not made and miscalculations do not happen. Even then, as many of us know, horrible things happen, don't they? Like the wrong limb amputated or surgical instruments left in the body. For example, in a 6.5-year period, doctors in Colorado operated on the wrong patient 25 times and on the right patient, but the wrong place 107 times in a 6.5-year period. But at least there's an admission of this fallibility and there are remedies for it. Where is there a remedy for the travesty, for example, of welfare or Obamacare or the bankruptcy of Social Security? The Mercury and Apollo programs that put Americans in space and on the moon took great care for the safety of their astronauts. We sent chimpanzees up first, didn't we? We took small steps. There were safety protocols at every juncture. Practice, and test again before actually launching. Even then, terrible things happened, though. human fallibility at work. On January 27, 1967, I remember that day where I was, three astronauts were killed in a training accident. Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee. He was from my hometown, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Roger Chaffee. They died in their Mercury capsule on the launch pad when the pure oxygen they were breathing suddenly exploded and consumed them in a ball of flame. Despite the discipline and the recognition of human error, tragedy happens. Why cannot government admit the same thing when a Border Patrol agent dies by the very guns his government has been buying and sending across the border to Mexican drug cartels, huh? The Fast and Furious scandal that's sweeping the administration recently? Even in the church, there is a frank admission of the fallibility of its leaders and pastors, at least in denominations that still discipline. This is precisely why the Orthodox Presbyterian Church has a form of government and in it a book of discipline. Yes, a book of discipline. What, you may say? Pastors and elders that sin and do wrong? Yes. There is a frank admission in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, anyway, that reverends are not always so reverent as they should be, and elders do not always behave with the dignity requisite of one who should know better, an elder. If you have been wronged by a minister or elder of the church in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, you have recourse. We underlined this with our prospective members just this past Friday. It's fresh in my mind yet. You have recourse. The courts of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Sessions, presbyteries. You can charge the minister or the elder and take it to session first, to the presbytery then, and even appeal it all the way to the General Assembly if necessary. We are accountable. We are fallible. We are sinful. Why not this admission by our government rulers? How is it they get away with egregious violations of the Constitution, like dictating executive orders that have the effect of law, or federal agencies that pass rules that have the effect of laws that only Congress should be passing? Instead, government sees itself as aloof, above mere mortal fallibility, not subject to critique and accountability. They are all wise, all knowing, and capable of making a mistake. They are the ones anointed to take care of you and govern you. Classic example came out this week, posted on the Obama re-election campaign website, The Life of Julia, it's called. And in it, a fictional character, Julia, is followed in her life from cradle to grave, showing how Obama government programs help her live a fuller, more fulfilled life. Infant programs, women, infant, and children, for example, the food program, preschool, student loans for college, small business loans at government expense, all the way to Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, and retirement, of course. It's supposed to convince the browser that big government is good for us, and that Obama will bring us more and more of it. Of course, for every benefit, there is a cost. Who will pay for all of these things? What about the massive government inefficiency that wastes and abuses our tax dollar by its very nature? The recent GSA scandals, for example, or the Secret Service scandals. Government who, by its mere existence, does not create wealth. You know this. I've taught you this many, many times. Government, by its very nature, cannot create wealth. Never created a nickel's worth of wealth ever in the existence of the earth. Private sectors do this. Government will, by definition, deplete the very wealth base upon which government relies for its resources. There's a very destructive dynamic that takes place when government grows and the private sector shrinks. Government slowly but surely strangles the very goose that lays the golden eggs upon which government depends. Government is by nature a parasite. Government is by nature a parasite, a necessary parasite. There was a symbiotic relationship. The question is the government a wise parasite? Sucking enough resources to live and no more, allowing the host to live? Or is it a foolish parasite, sucking and sucking and sucking resources until the host dies? We have reached the tipping point where government has gone into the latter category. It is sucking and sucking and sucking to where it is what Koheleth would call a foolish parasite. Government is killing, not encouraging, the golden goose. How foolish we are as a people to think that we can get something for nothing from government and have government take care of us from cradle to grave. We're finding we're having fewer and fewer cradles and much more graves, aren't we? More and more graves. Ronald Reagan said the most fearsome 9 words in English are, "Hello, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you." Mark Twain said there's no native criminal class in America except Congress. And Mark Twain also says, suppose you were an idiot. And suppose you were a member of Congress. But I repeat myself. Brian Chapman, a British parliamentarian, said, at the very heart of government is a rich and voluntary lack of talent. The upshot is government, like every other institution of man, is fallible and weak. It has fallen, liable to human error. Our founding fathers tried to ensure this by tried to ensure that this indeed would be mollified, limited, and controlled in some measure by having small, limited governments. Government, like every other institution of man, is fallible and weak. It is fallen and liable to human error, if we are honest. Who understood this better than Koheleth? In his day, government was embodied in a king and, by extension, his court. What was to be the conduct of a courtesan, then? One who inhabited the precincts of the court of the king. As a king himself, Solomon the second following David, Solomon the third following David, Solomon observed all of the points that we will elaborate below. It's a sobering warning to all who serve in the godlike place of a ruler. But it is also an encouragement to those who are aware that they serve not only a master below the sun, but also one above the sun. So let's look into these sobering warnings that Koheleth gives to us. We have our text broken down into 4 discrete points. You have this on the inside flap of your bulletin if you wanted to follow along with us. Chapter 9, verses 13 through 16. First of all, point 1. When in service to a government official, I've just extended this from king or ruler to apply it to us. When in service to a government official, do not expect appreciation for sacrificial service. Do not expect appreciation for sacrificial service. And then he elaborates in verses 13 through 16, a very creative and enigmatic parable for our day as well as his. It is for Solomon a metaphor, a trophy, an example, as he says in verse 13, of wisdom under the sun. This is a phrase for what is observable, of course, in our experiential world, that world under the sun, what is true in a philosophical world apart from biblical wisdom. It seemed great to Koheleth because of its universal application across human experience. And against all odds, in this parable, wisdom prevails. There's enough historical matter in this as well that it is probably an historical example to which he is alluding. And he compares that which is small with that which is great. A little city and a great king. Composed of few men, the king with his many mighty siege works, and then there is in that city a poor wise man. and a foolish shouting king. What is the crucial difference? Why is it indeed that the city triumphs? It is wisdom over folly. In the actual outworking of redemptive history, the city was saved by the poor wise man, not because he was poor, the virtue, of course, of the Marxist socialist in modern society. If you're poor, you are automatically virtuous. But because he was biblically wise. He was biblically wise. We're not told the precise modus operandi by which this wise man saved the city. Did he negotiate favorably and cleverly with his enemy? Did he develop a secret weapon with which he threatened the besiegers? Did he make a city appear stronger than they were in reality? We are not told the modus operandi, but that he did, by his wisdom, in fact, save the city. This he did by his chokmah, his wisdom. Now, a great deal of energy has been expended by scholars trying to identify the precise historical reference. A lot of pages to wade through when you're preparing for the sermon or studying this text, and I've done all that for you. Was it Archimedes saving Syracuse from the Romans by sinking their ships in 212 BC? Was it the besieging of Dor by Antiochus the Great in 218 BC? Perhaps the besieging of Bethsura by one of his descendants, Antiochus V. The rescue of Athens by Themistocles. The besieging of Abel by Bethmaaca in 2 Samuel 20. Or the deliverance of Thebes in Judges 9. All of these have been options that have been promulgated by one commentator or another. But none of them quite fit. But as perplexing as they may seem on its face, remember what St. Augustine observed long ago. He said, "Let your overwrought curiosity be satisfied with this. Solomon notes for us that this incident has sunk into the mists of forgetfulness." No one remembers anymore. That's the precise point he's making. The primary point meant to be delivered by this parable is what Koheleth observes about the net effect of his labors, yet no one remembered. No one remembered that poor man. Once again, we are struck with the Zakar motif in this text, are we not? The Zakar. Zakar is Hebrew for remember. And that's a theme that we find all the way through here, do we not? You see this coming around again? No one remembers from generation to generation. If you cast your mind back, if you remember, if you haven't forgotten, you may remember from chapters 1 and 2, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be, he says. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, Koheleth has already told us, seeing that in the days to come all will have been forgotten. The wise dies just like the fool. How fleeting, how vaporous the remembrance of what we've covered previously maybe is, much less even this one wise Savior. Yet in the last analysis, Koheleth does not sink into despair. Things are not vain and meaningless, are they? But he affirms wisdom. He says, "But I say," and this is emphatic in the Hebrew, "but I say that wisdom is better than might. Though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his wisdom is not heard." Even so, wisdom is to be preferred above folly. It is better than might. And this is practically applied to for us in the next verses. Verses 9:17 through 10 and 1. The chapter division there artificially separates verse 1 there from 16 and 17. And it shouldn't. So I'm including... 17 and 18 and 10 and verse 1. They go together. Verse 1 and chapter 10 goes with the previous two verses. And these verses constitute a brace of Proverbs, three of them, with a common theme. The input of one fool can destroy the careful counsel of many wise men. And he knows this. He knows this to his toenails, doesn't he? And this includes for us the decider-in-chief, as Bush called himself, the decider-in-chief, that is the king. And how often we see this replicated on the stage of history, as well as in our own personal lives, too, do we not? Even sitting on sessions, sitting at presbytery, the counsel of a fool can destroy and dismantle and distract the counsel of many wise men. In the fateful year 216 BC, the great Carthaginian general Hannibal set a trap for his Roman counterpart, General Terentius Varro at Cannae. It's in south central Italy. They still have a tour of that battlefield if you were to go there. Hannibal was a master of the art of war. He knew his enemy. It's one of Sun Tzu's principles in the art of war. Know your enemy thoroughly so you can act and react with him. Varro was impetuous and brash. This Roman general was prone to letting his temper get the better of him and acting upon that rather than good counsel. And so Hannibal proceeded to taunt and lure Varro into a trap that he had set for him and his 70,000 troops under his command. Varro was supposed to wait for his counterpart, Aemilius Paulus, to meet up with him, but he rashly committed his forces to battle when he thought that he had Hannibal trapped. Hannibal led him into thinking that he had Hannibal trapped, when indeed, instead, Hannibal, knowing that he would do this, sprung his own ambush and annihilated every last trooper in Varro's legion. 70,000 men in one day. One historian notes with profound respect, "How long does it take to kill 70,000 men by the sword? Apparently, about 6 hours. The time it took for Hannibal to utterly butcher Varro's legion. It was the greatest single defeat for Rome in all of her 1,000-year history." So, Varro was the poster boy for verses 17 and 18. "The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. But one sinner destroys much good." Well then, how was Hannibal ultimately defeated? Well, by a general wiser than him. General Quintus Fabius. That name ring a bell? Quintus Fabius? Fabius realized that Hannibal was indeed a tactical genius. Whenever Rome faced him in a regular pitched battle, he'd defeat whatever Rome could throw at him. But Fabius also realized that despite this genius and the bravery and the resourcefulness of his Carthaginian troops, they were a long way from home and had to live off the land. They could not ultimately hold any territory that they won in battle either. Therefore, Fabius waged a war of attrition on Hannibal, destroying small foraging parties sent out to look for food and supplies. He drew Hannibal into terrain where he couldn't fight these large pitch battles. Additionally, he moved populations in front of his armies and he destroyed crops and food supplies that Hannibal might use. It took a long time. But eventually, Hannibal's army was so reduced that he fled the Italian peninsula altogether. Rome intuitively blanched at this kind of strategy. It wasn't the way they'd won before. They preferred the confrontational pitched battle model. And Fabius was dismissed initially from his command. As one historian says, though militarily successful, the Fabian strategy was a political failure. Then came Cannae. Fabius was recalled. And eventually he was proven successful. And ever since, this strategy developed by General Quintus Fabius, a strategy of attrition by small incremental steps, little by little, winning small victories here and there, has borne his name, the Fabian strategy. Those of you who have studied political science, you know about the Fabian strategy. You know about the Fabian Society, for example. Socialists, Marxist socialists in England who founded the Fabian Society back in the last century, with precisely this strategy for Marxist socialism. Indirection, attrition, small steps, incremental steps, we will gain our agenda. It's precisely how liberalism has been victorious in England and America, with the Fabian strategy. Solomon knew this all too well. Sounds like the voice of experience, doesn't it, here in this text? The input of one fool can destroy the careful counsel of many wise men, whence our cliche, a fly in the ointment, comes right from this text. In fact, despite this valuable tract, this tract of wisdom written for his sons, right? Hopefully they would read it and learn from it. What happened? What happened to his first son? The one that immediately succeeded him? Let's turn to 1 Kings 12 for just a minute. Be reminded again that one fly can spoil the ointment. One fool can indeed spoil the counsel, the wise counsel constructed by many. 1 Kings 12, about 1 through 11, let's read. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. And as soon as Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard of it, for he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon, then Jeroboam returned from Egypt. And they sent and called him and Jeroboam, and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we will serve you. He said to them, go away for 3 days, then come again to me. So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer this people? Note carefully their counsel. And they said to him, if you will be a servant to this people, all good leaders are good servants as well to their people, right? If you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them while you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. But he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, what do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, lighten the yoke that your father put on us? And the young men who had grown up with him said to him, thus you shall speak to this people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you lighten it for us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. And now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. Advice of wise or advice of fool? This. In fact, Koheleth seems almost to foreshadow this bad company with whom his son will consort, does he not? And he does this in chapter 10, verses 2 through 4. It brings us to point 3. Court. When in service to a government official, do not expect support for wisdom from colleagues. Oh, the old knife in the back routine. Perhaps you know this from office politics or university politics, right? Henry Kissinger said, university politics are so vicious precisely because the stakes are so small. Point 3. When in service to a government official, do not expect support for wisdom from colleagues. Verses 2 through 4. Well, from verse 2, we can say unequivocally that Solomon was a conservative, right? A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Is that what he's saying? As much as I'd wish it were to be, in reality, the right hand was the hand of strength and blessing. Was it not? In the ancient world, most men are right-handed. their strongest hand. I happen to be left-handed. My left arm, left hand are stronger and more skilled than my right. Parenthetically, did you know at one point our entire session was left-handed? Terry and myself and Dave and Hafton, all of us left-handed. We thought maybe that should be a requirement for service in, on our session. Well, we see this throughout Scripture. Indeed, that the right hand is the hand of strength and blessing. We read in Psalm 16 today, I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. And in Genesis chapter 48, we see Joseph. Joseph saw that his father, that is Jacob, laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim to bless him. And he took his father's hand to move it. Put your right hand on Manasseh's head. And from Matthew 25, of course, we allude to this sometimes in our prayer time when the Son of Man comes in his glory. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on his left. Right? Therefore, this allusion here, the allusion that Solomon makes here, is not political, as much as I want it to be, but theological. The wise tend to blessing, that is, and the fool to folly. In the council of the king, that's our context, the courtroom, the throne room, the place of judgment. In the council of the king, this can pit one counselor against another, can it not? Only in time and over extended periods can the wise be discerned from the fool. This is another reason that politics is called a blood sport, isn't it? Advisors often vie with one another for the attention and the ear of their boss, flattering when the counsel is taken, humiliating when it's not. Ronald Reagan deliberately fostered competition among his inner cabinet at the White House, he and his advisor team and his aides. This is one reason he had such a high turnover rate on his staff. The press was always aghast at this, at how fast his staff turned over. But it did tend to bring out the best advice eventually. It burned out man after man, causing animosity and competition and jealousy that endures to this day. George H.W. Bush was once heard to say of Reagan's chief of staff, Donald Reagan, I still hate that SOB. That's from the mild-mannered George H.W. Bush. But it just proves Truman's advice. Truman said, if you want a friend in Washington, D.C., go buy a dog. And here, with Solomon in the council of the wise, the fool eventually displays his colors. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he is a fool. Solomon picks up on a common theme in wisdom literature. We've been talking about a variety of motifs throughout Ecclesiastes, and this is another one. That is the derech motif, direction or lack of direction. The Hebrew word is derech, the derech motif. We've got the zakar motif, right, the remembrance motif. The shuv motif, that is the return motif. And now the derech motif, the idea of one's way or one's path. We still talk about paths and roads, right? Road, the road not taken, things like that. One who wanders, Proverbs 21:6 says, one who wanders from the way of good sense will rest in the assembly of the dead. Or from Proverbs 14, the wisdom of the prudent discerns his way, his derech, his path, his way. Or from Proverbs 13:6, righteousness guards him whose way, his derech, his path, his way, is blameless, but sin overthrows the wicked. Have you been observing the corruption trial of former Democrat presidential candidate and vice presidential running mate of John Kerry, John Edwards? Edwards is on trial for using campaign funds to support his mistress, by whom he had a child. There are so many unsavory aspects to this story, I feel like I have to take a shower after watching the news. He was cavorting with this woman even while his wife was dying of cancer, for example. But for our purposes, it is the foolishness of his closest advisor, Andrew Young. He and his wife, Sherry Young, conspired with Edwards to cover up the fact that his mistress's baby was Edwards. And they did this by claiming it was theirs. What a fool. What foolish counsel. The trial testimony was a litany of foolish decisions made by Edwards and his chief advisor. They lied, used campaign funds to pay off and support Edwards' mistress, and even brought the baby and mistress into the Young home, where they all were miserable. And eventually, of course, as lies like this usually do, came out. Could not be sustained. Everything was made evident. So, beware your counsel. Beware your counselor. Edwards also personifies our last verse in this section. That is, if the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. That sounds like the voice of experience, doesn't it? Perhaps Solomon's better counselors would do just that if Solomon lost his temper or blew a gasket, huh? Came to trust and rely on those counselors. Another senior advisor to Edwards, a man named Peter Scher, confronted Edwards at one point when he found out that Edwards was having this affair with Rael Hunter. And he said, "John, what are you doing?" And Edwards exploded in a torrent of profanity, telling him to back off. "I don't need a babysitter." And Scher quietly left Edwards to his own destruction, eventually being one of the men who blew the whistle on his crimes. So there's never a guarantee, is there? The fallibility of the human soul, the tendency towards sin and hubris, especially in those with power. There's never a guarantee that kings and magistrates and presidents will be wise, is there? In fact, we have evidence, direct evidence of the contrary so often in history. And we see this in the ironic counsel that Ahithophel gives to Absalom, do we not? You remember that Ahithophel, a close counselor to David, betrays David at Absalom's rebellion, turns coat, turns sides, and goes over to Absalom to counsel him, the wisest man in the land. And you remember then the advice that Ahithophel gives to Absalom. He says, "Give your counsel. What shall we do?" And ironically, Ahithophel gives the right advice. He says, "Chase down David while he's weak and on the run before he can resupply and gather more men." But Absalom does not count on his own foolishness. And Ahithophel does not count on the foolishness of Absalom either, who ignores that advice and he takes the crafty advice of Hushai. You remember Hushai? Hushai was on his way out of town with David as they were beating feet just ahead of Absalom and his troops. And David says, "Hushai, go back. Play the same game. Play betrayal, but give opposite counsel of Ahithophel and we'll see what happens." So Hushai does this. Hushai's crafty advice. He says, no, Absalom. You got to wait. Delay until you can build up strength because everyone knows what a valiant warrior David is." The irony, this whole section just betrays so much irony, doesn't it? What then does the smart fool, right? Wisdom does not always come with intelligence, does it? And Ahithophel is a smart, he gives the right advice, but he's a fool. Why is he a fool? He's a fool because he betrays the Lord's anointed. That's why he is a fool, an intelligent fool. What then does this smart fool do? We know from the text he puts his affairs in order, saddles up his donkey, and goes out and hangs himself. So we see then now with greater and greater clarity the corruption and the fallibility of government and those who rule, and how wise our founders were indeed in attempting to limit it with our written constitution. Solomon makes this point about the fallibility of the ruler in chapter 10, verses 5 to 7. That brings us to point 4. When in service to a government official, do not expect wisdom to be exalted above folly. In fact, expect just the opposite. The evil which Koheleth observes proceeds from the ruler. This sounds like autobiography too, doesn't it? Folly is glorified above wisdom. We see this with Solomon's love of horses and women, right? And woe to the land in which this is done, when folly is glorified above wisdom. The rich here is a metaphor for the wise man of achievement. Folly is exalted, wisdom is debased, slaves ride while princes walk. There's a dynamic that takes place in the human heart which seeks to constantly innovate, to try the new, to overturn what is proven to be godly and fruitful and biblical. If you read history, you see this pattern time and time again, do you not? It happened in Israel. Make us a golden calf like the other nation. So Aaron melts down all the gold and out comes a golden calf. What a coincidence. Give us a king like the other nations. And you can just hear one of his wives, you know, whispering in his ear that pillow talk. Solomon, dearest, set up an altar to Asherah in the high places like I had at home. Please. I miss that so. Please, Solomon. Can you just see it? Huh? The new, the innovative, overturn what is proven to be godly and fruitful and biblical. It happens in Christian cultures and societies as well. If you read history, you know Jean-Jacques Rousseau hated God and the church. He advocated returning to man's natural state. That was his buzzword. Let's all just return to our natural state instead of all this artificial culture around us. That is, his idea was a wild and uncultivated nature. The wild and uncultivated nature would return us all to the pristine naturalness, right? Pristine glory. Pure and more democratic. How true it was. How true it was returning to our original nature. Pure and democratic it was. And he gave France what has come to be known simply as the Reign of Terror. That's what that produced. Karl Marx hated God and built upon Rousseau, advocating atheistic communism, overturning Christ, constitutionalism, and capitalism. And all of these, and more in our own day, assert that although Christ, constitution, and capitalism may be good, giving us what we've got perhaps, well, atheism, democracy, and communism will be better. It'll give us even more. In fact, according to Marx, it is the inevitable progress toward which all of humanity is moving. It's inevitable. The covenant family is that upon which Western society has built a rich culture and heritage. The homosexual marriage will be even better. Labor, built on one's own self-interest and the interest of his family and community, has brought untold wealth and prosperity to millions over the generations. But labor built from each according to his ability to each according to his need. You know that where that phrase comes from? Sean Hannity went out and did a tour of the streets and said, how does that sound? From each according from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. That's right out of Karl Marx. And who gets to decide what you need? Oh, you're all benevolent government, of course. That's even better. Christ and his gospel is that upon which the church has flourished and grown, spread throughout the earth, sometimes like the seed growing secretly in places like North Korea and China. Spread throughout the earth, even here in Idaho, as the waters cover the sea, as Isaiah says. But we now know that religion is mere ignorant superstition. Atheism is even better, will bring us even more. Your rulers have set fools to riding, while the Prince of Peace walks in great humility. What fools they are, ultimately. Zedekiah was a fool for ignoring the counsel of Jeremiah, casting him into a cistern. Pilate was a fool for releasing the murderer of Barabbas, was he not? He should have listened to his wife, his best counselor. Have nothing to do with this man. Let him go. He's innocent. But instead, he executes the innocent man, Jesus. It is the very definition of this proverb, slaves on horses, princes walking on the ground like slaves. Isn't that? Folly, folly, foolish. But this particular folly is a folly that saves, does it not? The Apostle Paul plays with this wisdom motif, this wisdom theme of Koheles, does he not, in his own letters? Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 for just a minute. First Corinthians 1, beginning at verse 18. This is a direct seizure, if you will, of this genre, this motif, by the apostle. That is the wisdom literature motif of folly and wisdom. For the word of the cross is folly, he says. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through folly, through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs. That's why this is folly to them. No accompanying signs. And Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For consider your calling, brothers, and this calls out to you as well. You are meant to be hearkening to this as well. Consider your calling. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. See the tremendous irony of this and the beautiful use of folly to bring about God's wisdom, what is considered folly in the life of man. He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, whom God made our wisdom and our righteousness and sanctification and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. as you follow these Chokmah motifs, the idea of wisdom, know that indeed your wisdom is now in Christ as well as your sanctification and your redemption. So may you become the wisdom of God this day by believing in the folly of the cross, the wisdom from God that saves your very soul. Let us now then come to that place where